as it will if you deliberately lift submaximal loads very slowly. Bar speed is too fast when it actually adds momentum to the load on the bar on the way down, so that you must decelerate against both the weight on the bar and the effect of its excessive velocity on that load, where the effective load on the bar is actually heavier than the weight. You bounce too much when the bar slams your chest hard enough to change your position with the impact and then slows down markedly a couple of inches up from your chest. This excessive bounce occurs because you allowed the downward velocity of the bar to increase in an attempt to increase mechanical rebound, so that the initial upward velocity of the bar was due more to the physical rebound than it was to the actual drive off your chest. This means you had to loosen your position to let the bar speed up as it dropped. If it's bad enough, the bar path will change after the rebound as your elbows shift position from the lack of tightness in your lats and delts. The whole messy thing is a result of a lack of tightness on the way down, and it can be remedied in a couple of ways. One way to stay tight off the chest is to just barely touch it. You can't cheat the rep if you can't bounce the bar off your rib cage, and you can't bounce it if you just barely touch your chest. Think about just touching your shirt, not your chest, with the bar. Or you might imagine a piece of glass on your chest that you have to touch but cannot break. Visualizing a light touch usually works, but it deals with symptoms. The best way to fix a bouncing problem is to address it at its root by learning to be tight during the movement, and in a way that can be applied to other lifts as well. It is a way to conceptualize the lift so that tightness is built in and elastic energy can be stored in the eccentric phase for use in the concentric drive up. The bench press, like the squat, consists of two movements, lowering the bar and raising the bar. Don't think about lowering the bar. Just think about driving it up. As you lower the bar down to your chest, you should be thinking about driving up hard, not about the descent. Focus on up only. In an attempt to get ready for the upward drive, you will slow down the descent and be tighter as the bar approaches your chest, thus improving your rebound efficiency and minimizing rib cage bounce. By thinking about driving up while the bar is on the way down, you will have focused on the thing you are actually trying to do, at the best point in the movement to start the process. Lowering the bar is awfully easy, and if you think past that to the drive up, you will slow your descent as you prepare to actively drive the bar up. This excellent technique works for any exercise with an initial eccentric component. Upper back. This important group of muscles has two functions. First, the upper back needs to be firmly planted against the bench and used as a platform to drive against while the arms drive the bar up. When this is done correctly, the shoulder blades will be adducted, pulled together to make a flat spot on the upper back to push against the bench itself. This stable platform is the anatomical surface against which the kinetic chain begins. Stated another way, when you bench press, you drive the bench and the bar apart. The bar moves and the bench doesn't, but you push against both. The upper back and shoulders push against the bench, and they need to be tight while doing so, just as the hands are tight against the bar. Second, the shoulders in their adducted position and the upper back muscles, as they contract and rotate or tilt the upper back into a chest-up position, push the rib cage up and hold the chest higher above the bench. This approach increases the mechanical efficiency of the pec delt contraction by steepening the angle of attack on the humerus, as we discussed earlier. Keeping your back tight is sometimes a difficult thing to do, since so many other things are going on at the same time. So it needs to be learned in such a way that it requires little active attention. Think about the driving against the bench model and why you need your chest up. Then sit on the bench in the same position you assume before lying down to take the bar. Before you lie down, imagine a hand touching you right between the shoulder blades. And imagine pinching the hand between your shoulder blades. This pinching will also cause you to raise your chest as your upper back tightens, further contributing to a good position. Now, actively raise your chest, lifting it up as if to show someone your boobs. This is the position you will take against the bench. Now, lie down, take the bar out of the rack, and assume this position, making sure your shoulder blades are together and your chest is up high. Do a few reps, correcting your position before and after each one, and focusing intently on the way it feels to do it correctly. This way, the position becomes embedded quickly, and you can assume it without a lot of conscious thought or direction. During the lift, minimal shoulder movement should occur. If the shoulders move much, something in the upper back has loosened, and the chest has lost some of its up position. The thing that moves is the elbow. Now, it should be obvious that the humerus moves within the glenohumeral joint, so the shoulder movement referred to here is the forward shrug that novices often add to the end of the bench before being coached. Some minimal scapular movement is probably unavoidable, particularly in a set of more than a couple of reps. But if it is excessive, it will compromise your efficiency by adding to the distance the bar has to travel to lockout. This effect can be illustrated by examining what happens during a shoulder shrug and the distance it adds to the movement. Lie on the bench, pull your shoulders back into full adduction with your chest up in a good position and your back arched. Put your arms up with straight elbows in a position that simulates the start of the bench press. Note the position of your hands. Now, shrug your shoulders up off of the bench so that your shoulder blades come out of adduction and note the difference in position. There will be a 4 to 6 inch difference in the distance from your hands to your chest, from the shrugged back to shrugged up. This is the extra distance you have to push the bar if you don't keep your shoulders back. During a longer set, more than just a couple of reps, most inexperienced people will let their upper back deteriorate out of the shrugged position. If this happens, each rep is a little looser than the previous one, and the bar must travel a little further each time. At the end of a set of 5, reset your shoulder blades in chest up position. If you're able to move them much at all, then they've come out of position. Your goal is to be able to do all your reps without losing this set. Neck. The function of the neck muscles is to maintain the head's position and to protect the cervical spine during the loading of the chest and upper back as the bar comes down on the chest. The neck muscles therefore function isometrically to maintain position in a role similar to that of the lower back muscles during the deadlift. But unlike the back muscles, the neck muscles should not transfer power along the neck to help with the lift. In other words, do not use your neck to bench press. Do not push your head into the bench, even if you've been told that it will create a stronger rebound off the chest. It very well might, but this is an excellent way to injure your neck. You need to learn how to tighten up your neck without pushing on the bench with the back of your head. As a practical matter, this involves holding your head about 1/4 inch off of the bench during the rep. Think about just touching the bench with your hair instead of touching it with your head. If your head is held off the bench, your neck muscles are tight. It is tempting to use the neck to push the bench, as it adds contracted muscle and tightness to the upper back area. But it is a dangerous habit, and you don't want to let it become established in a novice lifter. If you become a competitive lifter and decide that pushing your head forcefully into the bench is enough help to your bench press to warrant the risk, fine, go ahead. But save that for later when you're in a better position to evaluate the cost-benefit situation. Likewise, do not get in the habit of shifting your head so your eyes can see one side of the bench uprights when you're racking the weight. Doing so requires that your fatigued neck rotate under a load, and this is just dumb. You know where the rack is, and if your grip has been set correctly, your elbows are locked, and your spotter's been instructed even a little tiny bit, the bar will get back into the rack just fine without your having to look at one side of the uprights. Lower back, hips, and legs. The bench press is an upper body exercise, but since the lifter's feet are on the floor, everything between the feet and the upper body has the potential to be somewhat involved in the exercise. The lower back and the hips are thus the connection between the ground and the upper back. Strictly speaking, the kinetic chain begins at the bar and ends at the upper back bench interface. The legs are not in the kinetic chain because they don't move the bar. You know this because a large percentage of your 1RM can be performed with your feet sticking straight up in the air with no contact to the ground at all. Since the movement itself is not dependent on the feet and legs, they are not part of the kinetic chain. Kinetic equals movement, chain being components. In the same way that the arms are not part of the kinetic chain of the squat, but the correctly utilized back, hip, and leg positions actually represent an important connection to the ground. In the same way, the arms are a necessary connection to the bar in the squat, even though they're not an actual part of the kinetic chain, the legs do more than stabilize the lower body as the bars move through its path, although that is a major part of their function. Used correctly, the legs drive against the floor, transferring force horizontally along the bench, through the hips, into the arched back to reinforce the arch and keep the chest in its high position, established when the shoulders were pulled back together. The hips and legs thus function as a brace for the chest and the shoulders, giving the upper body a connection to the floor and allowing the lower body to contribute to the movement. Before you have a chance to misinterpret, this is not the same thing as bridging or heaving the bar up. That happens when the butt actually comes off the bench. Correct use of the legs and hips involves only the maintenance of chest and back position, with the force directed horizontally back along the bench and not vertically up off of the bench. The descent of the bar tends to drive the elevated chest back down, taking the arch out of the back if it is inadequately supported. The legs drive from the feet against the floor back up along the bench using a controlled isometric knee extension with a slight hip extension produced by isometric contraction of the glutes and hamstrings. They actively counter the loss of arch in the back and chest by reinforcing the arch from the floor. But a common problem usually follows the realization that the legs are useful in the bench press. Bridging, the intentional heaving of the hips clear of contact with the bench in order to meet the bar earlier, occurs as the lifter attempts to increase the chest height by using his lower body to steepen the angle of his upper back on the bench. Bridging takes work away from the target muscles by making the range of motion shorter. The popular gym exercise known as the decline bench press takes advantage of this position of increased mechanical efficiency. Most people can decline more than they bench, thus the popularity. Some purists believe that we are cheating when we arch the back at all. But this program seeks to use all reasonable means to increase strength on the bench press and increase the amount of muscle mass involved in the movement. Bridging is a good place to draw the line. Lifting the butt off of the bench has got to be learned as forbidden in the same way that use of the hands is in soccer. The temptation is always there, but if the correct habits are learned early, it will not usually be a problem. The back arch is easy to learn. Assume your position on the bench and imagine someone shoving a hand under your low back as you keep your butt in contact with the bench. Then imagine a clenched fist doing the same thing. Keep your lats in mind when you assume this position. Remember that you cannot raise your butt up off the bench, so it's better to learn to arch without cheating from the beginning. Make yourself do it correctly and resist the temptation to bridge your ass up off of the bench. Feet. Your feet are your connection to the ground. If your foot slips during a heavy bench press, the position supported by the lower body, your back arch and your chest up position, everything you're using to push the bar, collapses. The feet must be in the correct position on the floor, and they must be positioned against the floor correctly. Foot placement on the floor has two variables, width and placement relative to the hips. The feet need to be far enough apart to provide lateral stability for the hips and, through tightness in the trunk muscles, the torso as it is planted on the bench. An excessively wide stance is seldom a problem, as it is uncomfortable and hard to maintain. A narrow stance does not guarantee disaster, and many competitive lifters prefer this position. In fact, for a competitive lifter, any stance that facilitates a legal bench press with optimum chest position is just fine. But a novice has enough to worry about with just learning how to move the bar correctly, and a moderate width stance presents fewer technical problems. More of a problem is placing the feet up too far, back under the hips with the knees at a closed angle. This position predisposes you to bridge your butt up in the air, and that is usually the reason people do it. If you got your feet too far up under your butt and too close together with your heels up off the floor, you're going to bridge the heavy ribs. A wider stance tends to moderate this effect. If the feet are up too far in a closer stance, the knee extension, being done from a more closed knee angle, tends to raise the hips. A more moderate knee angle generates force more parallel to the torso. Having the feet too far down with the knees too straight is commonly seen in novice lifters who have yet to learn how to use the hips and legs. This position makes it difficult to get enough bite against the floor to generate and maintain good tension in the upstream components. Your foot position should be set so that your shins are nearly vertical, give or take a few degrees either way, in both axes. This way, your knees are almost directly over your feet and any width without any adduction of the femurs. This position allows for efficient use of your legs in reinforcing the arch, but it doesn't create a predisposition to bridge. Now, this is not to say that everyone with their feet up under the hips will bridge, but most lifters who bridge do so from this position, a little wider foot position, particularly with the feet in full contact with the floor, will make it difficult to bridge because the slack has been taken out of the hips. The proper position for the feet is flat against the floor, so that the heels can be used as the base of the drive up the legs. As with most of the things in the weight room, your heels need to be nailed down to the floor. If you're up on your toes, you cannot use the force of knee extension nearly as efficiently as you can if your heels are planted, unless your feet are back under the hips. Flat feet are stickier feet, better connected to the ground through more surface area. A less than flat position represents a less than complete contact with the floor. Any rolling of the feet to either side during a rep implies that the knees have moved, the chain is loosened, or the floor connection has been interrupted. If you keep your heels down, driving off them with flat feet, the problem goes away. A bad problem when it occurs is an actual foot slip. It usually happens when the weight is very heavy and the floor connection is loaded heavily and therefore crucial. A foot slip results in a disruption and collapse of the lower body support for the kinetic chain at the top, and usually a missed rep or attempt. And any miss with a heavy bar can be dangerous. A foot slip is usually caused by conditions on the surface of the floor or the soles of the shoes, like the presence of baby powder, as is used on legs in the deadlift in some meets, or as an aid in putting on a tight squat suit, or just perhaps a dirty floor. There are people, usually casual trainers, fitness enthusiasts, or retired powerlifters, who insist on benching with their feet up on the bench or even held up in the air. The effect of either position is to eliminate the use of the lower body during the movement and thus make the bench press less efficient than it would be with the brace against the floor. It is useful for a trainee with a lower back injury that makes spinal extension painful, distracting, or otherwise contraindicated, but who still needs to bench. If you prefer to bench with your feet up, it might be due to lower back discomfort caused by a lack of lumbar flexibility. If the spinal ligaments are too tight to permit the degree of spinal extension that the normal bench press position requires, stretch it a little bit. If your back is okay, you should be able to keep your feet down on the floor. Blocks or barbell plates stacked up under the feet can be used to add height to the floor for inflexible people until they stretch out or to accommodate people with shorter legs. The net effect of the use of the lower body is to increase the weight that can be lifted. So putting your feet up lowers the amount of weight lifted, but the exercise can still be done without it. The decision to do a feet-up bench should be made by a lifter who is cognizant of the benefits of training around injuries and the limitations inherent in doing it this way. Breathing. As it is for all barbell exercises, air is support for the bench press. In the squat and deadlift, the Valsalva maneuver, as described in detail in the squat chapter, provides increased back support. In the bench press, it provides support for the chest. This support takes the form of increased tightness throughout the thoracic cavity due to the increase in pressure provided by the big held breath. A tight rib cage allows for more efficient transfer of power to the bar by the muscles attached to the rib cage when they contract. If the pec and delt origins on the external chest wall contract against a tight structure that does not move when they contract, then more of the force of that contraction can be transferred to the end of the kinetic chain that does move the bar. When the rib cage is tight, less force gets absorbed or dampened by the movement of the chest. This tightness, along with the support provided by the lower body connected to the ground, radically increases efficiency in the bench press. Also, in the extended spinal position that the arch requires on the bench, the abs cannot tighten as effectively. They cannot, therefore, as effectively increase intra-abdominal pressure to contribute to the needed increase in intrathoracic pressure, thus making the big breath the primary source of support for the chest. The pattern of breathing during the bench press depends on the length of the set and the abilities of the lifter. Novices should take a breath before each rep, hold it during the rep, and exhale at the lockout, using the very brief break between reps to make sure that everything is positioned correctly. More experienced lifters may prefer to use one breath for the whole set. Any exhalation involves a certain amount of loosening of the chest to exhale and re-inhale, and some lifters may decide to stay tight and do the whole set in one breath if it is important and if they can hold their breath that long. Most people can manage only 5 reps this way before the discomfort from the hypoxia becomes too distracting. For a longer set, then, some quick breaths will be required. The breath has to be taken before the rep. If the breath is taken during the rep, the lungs will incompletely fill due to the loading of the rib cage by the now contracting pecs. If the breath is taken at the top with locked elbows, the pecs are not pulling on the rib cage, and a more complete inhalation can take place. Moreover, when the bar actually starts down, everything should already be tight, from the floor to your fingernails, and this tightness will prevent you from taking a really big breath, if you're tight enough. If you can breathe during a rep, you're not tight enough. No breath taken during the set will involve the complete exchange of the full tidal volume of your lungs. This takes too long, requires too much relaxation, and it is unnecessary. Breathing during the set consists only of topping off the huge breath taken before the first rep after a quick exhalation that might consist of only 10% of the tidal volume. The short refresher of air is just enough to allow the set to be finished more comfortably. The fact that it amounts to so little air is the reason you might decide to forego it in favor of maintaining tightness by not breathing after you practice it. Now for the safety part of the chapter, racking errors. Taking the bar out of the rack and putting it back in may seem like a rather innocuous part of the exercise, and most people give it no thought. Please be aware of the fact that any time a loaded bar is located above your face and throat, you have a potentially dangerous situation. The unracking and racking procedures must be done correctly from the beginning, because most of the danger involved in this most dangerous exercise in the weight room is associated with getting the bar in and out of the rack. So, in the interest of furthering safety in the weight room, here are the rules. Rule number one, do not use a thumbless grip on the bench press. If the bar is not secure in your grip, it is not secure at all. A thumb around the bar by no means guarantees that you will never drop the bar, but a thumbless grip increases by an order of magnitude the likelihood that you will drop the bar. Rule number two, anytime the bar is coming out of the rack or moving back into the rack, it will be over your throat and face, right? Therefore, when the bar is moving into or out of the rack, your elbows must be locked. This rule applies whether you're being spotted or not. The triceps should lock the elbows over the rack hooks so that the bones of the arm are in a straight line and the weight is being supported by the skeletal components instead of by the muscles when the bar moves over the head and neck. The first thing you do when unracking the bar is to lock your elbows before you move the bar into position. The last thing you do when racking the bar is to unlock your elbows after the bar touches the uprights. Rule number three, start and finish every rep from the start position over your shoulder joints. Now, it's common to see novices stop the bar as it comes out of the rack short of the starting position at a point over the throat. Lower the first rep to the chest at too great an angle, and then come straight up to the correct position to start the second rep. Some people get in the habit of taking the bar down to the chest right out of the rack, but the bar should never start down before it is in place. If it does, there will be bar path problems due to the lack of an initial ceiling reference for position and the fact that the bar is going back to a different place than it started from. You're not using the eyeball method. Both of these problems create the potential for killing yourself, so don't make either mistake. Only after the bar gets all the way out to the start position and your eyes have found their place against the ceiling should the bar start now. Rule number four. Never shove the bar toward the rack before the rep is finished at the lockout position. Many people do this on the last rep of the set. They're in a hurry to rack the bar. Always wait until the rep is locked out in the balanced start position over the shoulders before you move the bar back to the rack. If you're going to miss a rep and your spotter fails, it is preferable to have the bar come back down on your chest rather than on your face or your mouth or your throat. If you don't make it to the rack with the bar, your bent elbows cannot support a heavy load over your face. This sloppy habit indicates a lack of patience, an unwillingness to take a few extra seconds to do things correctly and safely, and a lack of respect for heavy weights that can hurt you very badly in this position. Rule number 5. If you're benching heavy by yourself, always, for the love of God, always bench inside a power rack with protections from the pins of the rack set at the proper height. You can set the pins at a level just barely below your chest, so that if you miss a rep, you can lower the bar to the pins, relax onto the pins, and escape safely. If you do not have a power rack, do not bench heavy by yourself. This is what kills more people with barbells every year than any other stupid thing people do with barbells. If you get trapped under a heavy bar, it can kill you. Really, it happens. Rule number 6. If you insist on not following rule number 5, at least have enough common sense to not collar the plates on the bar. If you secure the plates with collars for safety, like the poster in the weight room explained to you once upon a time, and you get stuck under the bar by yourself, you can't tilt the bar, slide the plates off, and get out from underneath it like you could if you didn't have collars holding the plates in place. Even the cost of wrecking the room, totaling the room completely out by dumping the load on one side of the bar, would be cheaper than your ass, which you'll admit is a higher price to pay. And rule number 7. If your spotter has to take the bar, do not release your grip on the bar. Help the spotter get the bar back in the rack. Leaving the spotter with a heavy bar unsupported from below will get both of you hurt badly, his back and your face. If your spotter is attentive enough to do his job correctly, please be good enough to help the bar get back into the rack. Unless the spotter is very strong or the weight is very light, a loaded barbell any distance at all from his center of balance cannot be handled with just his arm strength. If you bail out of a rep and leave the spotter with what is most assuredly your problem, you will not be likely to get much help next time you need a spot. Spotters. In many gyms around the world, bench pressing is a team activity. The guy on the bench is doing chest, while the guy standing over his head is working on his traps. It is truly amazing how much weight two guys working together can bench press in this way. It is not an exaggeration to say that the vast majority of big gym bench presses are in fact exaggerations. If the spotter puts his hands on the bar during the first rep and keeps them there for the rest of the set, then who has lifted what and why? There is a perfectly legitimate place in the weight room for spotters, obviously, but it is not in the middle of someone else's work set. Spotters should not be there to help with the set. Spotters should be there to help get the bar out of the rack and into the start position over the shoulders by helping to overcome the long moment arm between the rack and the shoulder joints. The problem with many spotters is that they create more problems than they solve. The bench press is actually a simple movement to learn correctly, and more people have problems with their spotters than they do with the exercise itself. Spotters should be there for safety, when a question of safety exists. For everybody except rank novices, the first warm-up sets of the bench press are not a safety concern and do not require spotters unless the spotter is also performing a coaching function. As the weight gets heavier, a spot becomes more necessary. Some people need one on the last warm-up set, and everyone should be spotted on the work sets, because the weight is supposed to be heavy. Excessive caution and the insistence that every set be spotted for everybody is inefficient, unnecessary, and bothersome to the other people in the gym who are actually trying to train. But if your gym contains mostly people who can't be bothered to help you when it is legitimately necessary, could be a problem. Get a spot when you need to, and know when this is. For the bench press, a competent center spot will suffice for all but the very heaviest attempts, the kind reserved for a meet, unless you're training at a national level power gym. A good handoff is one of those rare commodities, unfortunately. There are more bad ones than good. A bad handoff interferes with the lifter's timing, balance, view of the ceiling, and concentration by the spotters attempting to participate in the rep. A good handoff spotter is experienced and appropriate with the timing and amount of bar contact. He's respectful of the mental requirements of the lifter, and above all, he's conservative about when and how much to help. The bench rest spotter stands behind the head of the lifter in the center of the bar. This position can be adjusted a little if necessary. The primary requirement of the position is that it is close enough for the spotter to grab the bar, but far enough back that after the handoff, the lifter has an unobstructed view of the ceiling. From this position, the spotter can do whatever might be necessary at the end of the set, from just watching the lifter finish the set to securing the rack by following the bar back in as it meets the uprights, all the way to taking the bar out of his sticking point. If you actually get stuck during a rep, your spotter needs to be the one to decide that this has occurred, that he will take the bar, and how much of the weight to take when he does it. The bar is stuck when it reaches a point of zero upward movement. This will shortly be followed by a deterioration in position as the bar begins to move back down. Sometimes you'll be able to tell the spotter to take the bar, and sometimes you won't. Your spotter has to accurately evaluate the bar velocity, being certain not to take a bar that's still moving up, yet not failing to take it before it sticks for too long or goes back down too much or too fast. After the spotter decides to take the bar, the amount of help provided will depend on the situation and a correct assessment of it. When someone is spotting an intermediate lifter with the last rep of the fifth set of five, the situation will warrant a different amount of help than in the case of an experienced lifter being spotted on a PR single or a novice trainee during the first heavy work set of his third workout. Each instance requires a different response in terms of how quickly to react, how closely to follow the bar, how much weight to take off with the spot, whether to help maintain the bar velocity, and how fast and how hard to help rack the bar. So, in the interest of fostering a constructive relationship between you and your spotter, here are the rules for spotters. Rule number one. At work set weights, the spotter always watches every rep and is ready to react to the lifter's situation. Complete riveted attention is not necessary for warm-up sets, for which the spotter's not coaching a novice, but for heavy sets, when the weight has the potential to cause problems, the spotter must be watching the bar. A spotter who is looking around the room during a heavy set is not spotting. Rule number two. This one is tough for many people because it seems to conflict with rule number one, so try to perceive the nuance here. After the spotter hands the bar off to the lifter, the spotter must stay out of the way until either the last rep is completed or the lifter needs help. The lifter is looking at the ceiling, right? So out of the way means out of the lifter's side picture of the ceiling and the bar. If you're the spotter, do not hover over the lifter and do not stick your hands anywhere near the bar because doing so will distract the lifter, who is staring at the position reference on the ceiling. Now, needs help means that the lifter cannot complete the rep. indicated by the fact that the bar is stopped moving up for more than 1 or 2 seconds, that the bar has started to move back down, or that the bar has moved in a direction other than up, like toward the face or toward the feet or sideways. Rule number 3. If you are the spotter and you determine that the lifter needs help, take the bar with both hands and guide it back to the rack hooks. The lifter should stay with you during this process, not releasing his grip on the bar. But unless the lifter actually needs help, see rule number 2, do not touch the bar. This rule must be strictly obeyed because any rep touched by anyone other than the lifter himself cannot be counted as a rep by the lifter. This means that a set of 5 reps, the last one of which was spotted, that is, touched in any way by the spotter, is officially, it's a set of 4. If you're the lifter, this rule keeps your rep count honest. Without it, you have no way of knowing how much help you were given, and therefore no way of honestly claiming to have done the whole set unassisted. If the numbers written down in your training log are not honest, you have absolutely no way to evaluate the results of your program, since there is no point in lying to yourself about your own workout. Counting an assisted rep as yours is pointless in the long term. This principle obviously applies to all the lifts that customarily require spotters. If you let your spotter help you on your work sets, you'll soon have absolutely no idea what you're really benching and no idea if you're making any progress. Rule number 4. This is worth repeating. Any rep touched by anybody other than the lifter does not belong to the lifter. As a spotter, you're responsible for controlling your desire to participate in the set. Your job is to help if necessary, not to share the work and share the glory. Stay away from the bar unless your help is actually needed. If you don't, the lifter has my permission to stand up and slap you on the ear for interfering with his potential personal record. For both lifter and spotter, when racking the bar, make sure that you touch the uprights first, the upright parts of the rack itself. Don't try to set the bar down directly on the flat horizontal surface of the hooks. If you, the lifter, move the bar back with locked elbows until it touches the vertical part of the uprights and then slide it down onto the hooks, you won't have to worry about whether it will stay in the rack. If the uprights are touched first, the bar will always be above the hooks. If straightening out your elbows got the bar clear of the hooks when you took it out, then locked elbows on the way back in will ensure that it's high enough to get back over the hooks to touch the uprights when you're racking it. If your arms are short, you need to use a bench with adjustable uprights or the power rack. But if you try to set the bar down on the horizontal surface first, then you are not all the way back to the uprights as you try to set the bar down. You are not all the way back to the root of the hook surface, and you will eventually miss the rack, usually one of the hooks on one side. This same advice applies to the squat for exactly the same reasons. Touch the uprights with the bar on the way back in the rack. Certain circumstances may require the use of 2 spotters, as during the heavy attempts at a power meet, but normal weight room conditions very seldom require more than 1 competent spotter. The problem with 2 spotters is the unalterable fact that 2 people cannot assist 1 lifter in a perfectly balanced way, especially when they must react quickly. The uneven loading that the lifter will inevitably experience is a potential source of injury. It's physically impossible for 2 people, even careful, experienced people, to pull upward with exactly the same amount of force on each side of a loaded bar. They will therefore subject the lifter to uneven loading at exactly the time when that stress is most likely to cause an injury, during a rep that is too heavy to lift. This is true of both the squat and the bench press. The problem with the bench press is solved with the use of the single spotter. A perfectly reasonable way to spot for the vast majority of bench press workouts in which the weight on the bar has been correctly selected. The power clean. The power clean cannot be done slowly. There is therefore no confusion over the nature of the exercise. In essence, power clean is an acceleration of the bar in the hands, after which the bar is caught on the shoulders. The power clean is used in sports conditioning because it trains explosion, and done correctly, it is the best exercise for converting the strength obtained in the other exercises to power. Other, easier-to-learn exercises, like the vertical jump, require explosion, and plyometrics have come into fashion in strength and conditioning for this reason. But the clean and the snatch are unique in their ability to be incrementally loaded with an increasingly heavy weight, making it possible to develop a more powerful explosion in a simple, programmed way. Since the nature of the vast majority of sports is explosive, involving the athlete's ability to accelerate his body or an object, the ability to accelerate is pivotal in sports performance. The power clean is our most important tool in this war against inertia. In his famous book, The Strongest Shall Survive, Bill Starr included the power clean in his Big Three, with the comment that, if your program only allowed you to do one exercise, this would be the best. The power clean has always been used by weightlifters as an assistance exercise for the clean, the more complicated version of the lift used in competition. The term clean refers to a way to get the bar clear of the floor and up to the shoulders, without soiling the bar by touching the body on the way up, as was required by the rules in place several decades ago. If this is accomplished in one movement, it is a clean. If it is done in two movements, if the bar stops on your belt or on the chest on the way up, it is referred to as a continental, due apparently to the absence of a rule against it in mainland European contests at the time. In modern usage, the term clean refers to a full squat clean. It has not always been this way. The split clean, a style that used a forward-back split like that commonly used for the jerk in modern Olympic weightlifting, was the standard version until the 1960s when the squat style began to be favored due to the heavier weights that could be lifted with this front squat-based technique. The term power as a qualifier in front of an exercise refers to an abbreviated version of a more complicated movement, the shorter version being harder to perform because the extra technique stuff is there to make it easier to lift more weight. A power snatch is a snatch without a squat or a split, the use of which reduces the distance the bar must be pulled. The power jerk is a version of the last part of the clean and jerk, but in the power jerk, the feet do not split. Likewise, the power clean is the version of the clean without a split and without a front squat. The power clean, therefore, requires more pull, in that the bar must travel higher as a result of the explosion, without moving the body to drop under the bar. As we'll see, the term is actually used correctly here as it pertains to the science of movement. Any clean requires the lifter to pull the barbell up fast enough and high enough by using power generated by the hips and legs to catch it on the shoulders. After the feet break contact with the floor, force cannot be applied to the bar. This is because the force is generated by the components of the body that are operating between the load in the hands and the feet on the ground. When the feet break contact with the floor, the bar is moving up as fast as it's going to be. It continues to travel upward due to the momentum it acquires during the active part of the pull. The faster the bar comes up, the higher it will go, because the faster it is moving, the more momentum it possesses. The heavier the weight, the harder this is to do. So the better a lifter is at accelerating the bar, the more momentum he can impart to the bar and the more weight he can clean. As a corollary, a lifter can clean more weight if he can get better at getting under a bar not pulled as high. This is the purpose served by both splitting and squatting. They both shorten the distance the bar has to travel by allowing the lifter to jump under the bar in a lower position. But since our purpose is sports conditioning and general strength training, not cleaning heavy weights per se, but rather generating as much upward acceleration as possible, we will use the power version of the lift. A few authorities have taken the position that the squat clean is the superior version of the lift for most training purposes, arguing that going under the bar, when the front squat is taught as part of the lift, translates into more foot movement and thus more athletic carryover. On this basis, a better case can be made for using a split clean, and a case can be made for the fact that the squat clean is easier on the knees, because the glutes and adductors can help absorb the shock of the catch. A novice's knees are not yet this tender, but be aware that the front squat will interfere with your back squat form if you are learning both movements at the same time. The novice using this method will devote considerable time and energy to the task of unlearning a quadriceps-dominant squat, the result of poor prior instruction or no instruction at all. Incorporating a front squat into the clean will complicate the process of learning the squat without making the clean any more explosive, our primary objective in doing it anyway. The front squat and the back squat are radically different exercises, and while competitive Olympic weightlifters must learn and train the front squat, the back squat is far more important to general strength and conditioning. Even when used as part of the clean, the front squat is best left to intermediate-level lifters to learn after good back squat technique has been nailed down by several months of training. This, in addition to the fact that a power clean moves through a longer range of motion, is the reason that power cleans are the recommended explosive lift for novices. The term power has a very specific meaning in the study of mechanics. Work is the amount of force applied to an object that makes it move a resulting distance, and this quantity expended per unit of time is power. Written as an equation, it is force times distance quantity over time, which equals P for power. F is the force, which would be strength. D is the distance over which the force acts, and T is the time it takes to perform this work. When we're referring to the total amount of work done over a longer period of time, the duration of a set of 5 reps, for example, the proper term is average power. When the time frame in question becomes very short, like the duration of a clean or snatch, the term used is instantaneous power, and that is what we are concerned with here. Physicists measure it in joules per second, or watts. In our discussion of the power clean and its application to explosive training in athletics, instantaneous power is what we're concerned with. It can be best understood as the ability to exert force rapidly, to display strength quickly. More terms now. Speed is the rate of change in the position of an object. If the direction of the speed is specified, we refer to the velocity of the object. The bar moving up at 2 meters per second, for example. Acceleration is the rate of change in velocity over time. The increase in velocity or decrease, known as deceleration, or how fast the velocity is changing. Force is the influence that causes acceleration. For an object to accelerate, force must be applied to it. Strength is the physical ability to generate force against an external resistance. It's difficult, as an aside, to define strength when it is applied isometrically. For example, when the application of force causes no movement of an object outside the body, but rather stays within the physical system of the muscles and skeleton. Isometric force production is an important part of barbell training. For example, your ability to hold your back nice and flat during a pull. But for purposes of defining strength, movement of the bar is our primary quantifying measurement. Power in the weight room is therefore the ability to generate force rapidly. A more familiar term for this might be quickness, especially when applied to the movement of the body itself. For many sports, just being strong is not enough. You must also possess the ability to rapidly employ your strength so that you can accelerate better, both your own body weight and that of a physical opponent or a thrown implement. A strong man might very well be able to apply enough force to a very heavy weight to get it moving, but a powerful man can get it moving more quickly. The standing vertical jump is a valuable diagnostic test for power. It directly measures an athlete's ability to generate force rapidly enough to accelerate his own body weight off the ground, and it is a valuable assessment of genetic capacity. It is used by the NFL as part of their combine test to predict this aspect of performance. Studies have shown that vertical jump performance is predictive of sports proficiency, that power clean performance is predictive of vertical jump performance, and that power clean performance is predictive of squat strength. Squat performance is predictive of squat jump performance, and squat jump performance is predictive of power clean performance. Strength and power are therefore inseparable qualities. The power clean, by training the athlete's ability to move a heavy weight quickly, is the glue that cements the strength training program to sports performance. One way to understand the concept of power in this specific situation is to compare performances in the power clean and the deadlift. As we have already seen, the deadlift is a straight pull up off the floor when the lifter is standing up with the bar and the bar stopping at arm's length, whereas the power clean continues the pull on up through an explosive phase to a catch on the shoulders. A power clean has a bar path that is about twice as long as the deadlifts, and it uses between 50 and 75% of the load of a heavy deadlift. Since work is calculated by multiplying the amount of force used to overcome the weight of the bar by the vertical distance the bar travels, and since the bar can be pulled perhaps 6 times faster in a power clean, maybe more than that, because it is half the weight of a deadlift, power outputs in a heavy clean might be 5 to 7 times as high as in a deadlift. A deadlift can obviously be done with a heavier weight because it is a shorter movement, with no inherent requirement to accelerate the bar. If you can just keep it moving, however slowly, you can lock it out. Remember, there can be no slow power cleans because they will not rack on the shoulders. But a heavy deadlift might well take 7 to 10 seconds to pull and will still qualify as a deadlift. Here is one of the most important facts about training for strength or power or sports or anything else. It is always true that a man with a 500-pound deadlift will clean more than a man with a 200-pound deadlift. Power is absolutely dependent on strength. Force production capacity that does not exist cannot be displayed, quickly or otherwise. However, between two men who both deadlift 500, the one moving it faster is producing more acceleration, more force over a shorter time frame, and thus more power. This capacity is the ultimate difference between a strong man and a strong athlete. The power clean is an incrementally increasable way to train this power. A very strong power lifter can deadlift 2 to 3 times the weight he can power clean, because he probably doesn't train the clean at all. In the early days of powerlifting, most competitors had weightlifting experience or were coached by people who did. This is no longer the case. A powerlifter's power clean might be 40% of his deadlift. In contrast, an Olympic weightlifter who does not train the deadlift might clean 85% of his deadlift. This difference is a direct result of genetics and training. At the elite levels, all sports favor a certain type of genetic predisposition. The elite powerlifter is an athlete who is good at moving heavy weights, and the elite weightlifter is good at moving moderate weights fast. Weightlifters tend to train with lighter weights explosively, while powerlifters concentrate their efforts on the slower movements that allow the use of heavier weights. A weightlifter who can deadlift only 450 pounds over a 385-pound clean has not trained with sufficiently heavy weight to develop his absolute strength. His clean would go up if he developed his absolute strength off the floor. There is no reason that a lifter with a 385 clean and a 450 deadlift can't get his deadlift stronger unless he's happy with a 385 clean. Or it could be that the power lifter with a 600-pound deadlift and a 240 clean is neglected to develop his power off the floor, powerlifting being a bad choice of words for the sport. It should be strength lifting, and that term is now being applied more honestly to a meet consisting of the squat, the press, and the deadlift. These examples illustrate a way to consider the relationship of absolute strength to power. You can think of the power clean as being done with a percentage of the deadlift. In other words, explosive strength is displayed as a percentage of absolute strength. The ratio between the two depends on training and genetics, and the vertical jump might be the indicator of the ratio. Training can improve the ratio to a certain extent, but genetics will limit this extent. What is certain is that as the ability to produce force increases, the potential to display that force as power goes up with it. The extent to which this is true at the extreme limits of performance is unclear, but for novice lifters, there is no question that the best way to make the clean stronger is to make the deadlift stronger. If this is true, why train the power clean at all, you ask? For some people, this is a legitimate question. Older people with old people's elbows, shoulders, and wrists may elect not to perform this exercise at all, as may very young trainees, people with poor athletic ability, older women, or people with osteoporosis, chronic knee tendonitis, or other problems that make the power clean more trouble than it is productive. But for most other people and all athletes, the power clean is the best way to keep the ability to display power on pace with increasing strength. The neuromuscular system. To understand the nature of power production by the human body, you need to understand the way the nervous system controls the muscles. A detailed discussion of the physiology of muscle contraction is outside the scope of this discussion and can be found in Practical Programming for Strength Training, 3rd edition, and in many other sources. Very short version. The muscles are composed of muscle fibers. These are controlled by the motor neurons, and the whole system of muscles plus the controlling nervous system is collectively referred to as the neuromuscular system. Each motor neuron controls many muscle fibers, and the term motor unit refers to one motor neuron and all of the muscle fibers to which it is connected. The contraction or firing of motor units by the neuromuscular system is called recruitment. It is considered to be an all-or-none phenomenon. The muscle fibers of the motor unit, when fired by a nervous impulse, come into contraction at 100% of their capacity to do so. This means that a submaximal muscle contraction is the result of a submaximal percentage of motor units being recruited. The greater the force production requirements of the task, the more motor units that are recruited into contraction. The ability to recruit motor units with great efficiency, that is, recruit high numbers of them quickly when a task demands instantaneous high levels of force production, is largely controlled by the genetic endowment of the individual. This ability depends on the density of motor neuron populations within the muscles, the quality of the nerve tissue, the quality of the nervous system interface with the muscle fibers, the type of muscle fibers and their ratio within the muscles, and other factors. Some of these factors can adapt to the stress imposed by training, but most cannot. The standing